Satan cursed, and the first promise. Genesis 3:14. And Jehovah God said unto the serpent, Because thou hast done this, cursed art thou above all cattle, and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. After judgment has been pronounced, and the whole case completely gone through, follows the execution of judgment, in which, as we shall now hear, there is rendered to each party according to their work, but not one like the other. Now this passage claims our thoughtful attention in the first place, because there is not found throughout the five books of Moses so long a speech in the person of God. And in the next place, because this divine speech contains no law whatever as to what the serpent or man was required to do, the whole speech is occupied in promising that good or threatening that evil which shall come upon each party concerned. And it is worthy our particular observation here that, after the sin of the fall, no further law whatever was imposed on Adam, though nature in its state of perfection had a divine law set before it. The reason of this was because God saw that nature, being now fallen and corrupt, could not only derive no help or relief from any law given to it, but that, being thus corrupted and also disorganized and confused altogether, it could not bear any symbol of law whatsoever. Wherefore God did not increasingly oppress nature, already thus oppressed by sin, with any further law of any kind. But on the contrary, God mercifully applied unto sin as a terrible wound, a healing plaster, that is, the promise concerning Christ, still using that caustic, the curse on sin, which the devil had caused to be inflicted. For as wholesome plasters, even while they heal, yet corrode and pain the flesh, so the healing promise is so set before Adam that the threatened curse on sin should be added to operate with it in curing the lust of the flesh. By the lust of the flesh I mean not only that foul motion and itching of lust, but also all manner of concupiscence and uncleanness of soul, as Paul terms them, Romans 7:8 and Ephesians 4:19, through which we are, by nature, inclined to idolatry, unbelief, self-security, and all other horrible sins against the first and second table. To curb and cure all this depravity of nature, we have need of the operation of this burning caustic, the curse of God on sin. I would that I could handle the text now before us in a manner becoming its depth and dignity, for it embraces all that is glorious in the whole Scripture, containing in it the curse of God on Satan and the destruction of the seed of the serpent by the seed of the woman. The former part of the text is wholly figurative. God speaks to the serpent, but it is manifest that the serpent alone is not here to be understood as addressed by God. For these are not the words of God as a creator, as were those words above, when he said unto the beasts of the earth, Be fruitful and multiply, nor when he said to the earth itself, Let the earth bring forth grass and herbs and trees, yielding seed after their kind. They are words of divine threatening and a declaration of mind and will, such words as God never speaks to an irrational creature, but to an intelligent creature only. God does indeed address the serpent by name, but he is, all the while, especially speaking to Satan, who ruled in the serpent, and by the serpent deceived the first parents of mankind. Nevertheless, as, on account of the sin of man, the Lord of the whole creation, all animals and all trees perished in the flood, just as the subjects of a nation are often punished on account of the misdeeds of their prince, so it befell the serpent. That animal also was punished because of the sin of the devil, who had abused the serpent in making use of it to work so mighty an evil as the sin of the fall. God, however, intends, figuratively, to be represented under this punishment of the serpent, the deluging punishment of Satan. The obscurity which lies in this figurative representation has been the reason why this text, which ought to be most clearly known and understood by all, has never, to my knowledge, been explained by anyone with sufficient diligence and clearness. And I have often wondered what the fathers and the bishops could have been about who, when occupied in the government of churches and in the condemnation of heresies, did not feel that they had a still more important duty to perform in devoting themselves with greater diligence to the explanation of such passages of the Scriptures as these. Such bishops and fathers possess nothing more than the name, for they may with more truth be called destroyers than watchmen or guardians of the churches. I am now speaking of those our fathers and bishops who really excelled in holiness of life and doctrine. Even among these, not one is found to have explained the text before us in any manner becoming its great dignity. Perhaps those various engagements which generally beset the rulers of churches too deeply involve them to leave them time for the purpose. The disgrace of our more recent divines is notorious. They have even shamefully corrupted this whole passage, and out of the neuter pronoun they have made the feminine, which, with the most open wickedness, they have thus wrested and have applied it to the Virgin Mary, "She shall bruise thy head," verse 15. I can pardon Lyra, who was, as it appears, a good man, but he conceded too much to the authority of the fathers, and hence he suffered himself to be drawn aside by Augustine to the most weak and foolish allegorizings, which system Gregory also followed in his Morals, maintaining that by the woman in this part of the sacred record ought to be understood the inferior power of reason, as by the man the superior power of reason, and by her seed the operation of good, but by the seed of the devil his evil suggestions. But what, I pray you, friendly reader, friendly hearer, is there of all such darkness of the most absurd allegories in all this clear light of the truth? But grant that we might with any propriety divide reason into two qualities or powers, the superior and the inferior. With how much greater propriety may we term that inferior power of reason which is adapted to the government of domestic and political affairs, and not that which is concerned in swine-like pleasure and gratification, calling that the superior power of reason, by which we contemplate those things which are separate from economy or polity, and which pertain unto religion, the solemn things of the Word, in which we do nothing operatively, but only contemplate and learn. Although we thus speak upon these things, what have they to do, after all, with the sacred text before us? Do they not altogether encumber and keep out of sight its real sense, and substitute a spurious sense in its stead, a sense which is not only useless, but pernicious? For what can reason do, or what light can it give in the divine matter of religion? There is also a further absurdity in this mode of interpretation, by which Eve is made to be the inferior power of reason. For it is perfectly evident that Eve was not inferior to her husband Adam in any sense whatever, that is, neither in body nor in soul. It is from this ridiculous mode of interpretation that all those profane disputations concerning free will have arisen, and concerning the doctrine that reason always prays for the best, etc., until all theology is lost in philosophy and sophistical absurdities. Wherefore let us, casting away all such pernicious and absurd follies, enter upon a new road of interpretation, caring naught for having disregarded the footsteps of those who have gone before us. For we have the Holy Spirit as our guide, not setting before us in Moses a heap of absurd allegories, but teaching us through him the mightiest truths and the mightiest things which took place between God the Creator and man the sinner and Satan the author of sin. First of all, then, let us settle it as a fact that the serpent here, spoken of by God, was a natural and a real serpent, but a serpent besieged and occupied by Satan, who spoke through and by that serpent. Let us next consider it to be a truth that those things which God spoke to the serpent are not to be understood as having been spoken to the serpent abstractly as a brute animal, but that the person immediately spoken to was Satan, to whom God was all the more expressly speaking. By this manner of interpretation, I am sure that I retain the plain and simple historical and literal meaning, and a meaning in accordance with the whole passage, by which meaning, as divinely intended, the serpent remains a serpent, though occupied and possessed by Satan. The woman remains a woman, and Adam remains Adam, all which is proved by what follows in the sacred narrative. For it is not an inferior power of reason and a superior power of reason who begat Cain and Abel, as recorded in the following chapter, but Adam and Eve, that is, the first parents of mankind, who fell by sin into death and became subject to the dominion of Satan. When, therefore, God says to the serpent, "Thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field, upon thy belly shalt thou go," the divine meaning is not that which Augustine gives and which his disciples follow. They understand that by belly is to be allegorically understood pride. But the divine mind in the passage is that as Satan abused the serpent in effecting the sin of the fall, so the serpent is compelled of God to bear a part of the punishment of that sin, and therefore is thus cursed above all cattle, that it might be the most hateful of all the beasts of the field. At the beginning of the creation it was not so, but now, through the divine curse, such a nature has been imparted to the serpent, that the creature which before the curse was the most delightful and the sweetest of all creatures is now hated and dreaded above every other animal of the creation. Hence we find, by experience, that we have a natural abhorrence of serpents, and that serpents, as naturally dread and flee from us. Thus the serpent is indeed made to bear this curse as part of the punishment of sin. These words, however, are not spoken unto the serpent only. God is dealing all the time with Satan in the serpent. It is on Satan that this sentence is pronounced as his final judgment. It is Satan that is here placed before God's tribunal. For God here speaks to the serpent in far different language from that which he used toward Adam and Eve, when he called them back in love from their sin. His language then, "Where art thou? Who told thee that thou wast naked?" All these particulars indicate the love of God towards the whole human race, showing forth that God will seek after man and will call him back after he has sinned, that he may reason with him and hear what he has to say. All this was a sure announcement of grace, for although these words of God, spoken to Adam and Eve, were legal and judicial words, yet they set before them a hope, by no means obscure, that they should not be condemned forever. But with the serpent and Satan, God by no means dealt so mercifully. He did not call Satan to him and say, "Why hast thou done this?" He pronounced upon him at once the sentence of judgment, and that, too, in the most awful words, "Because thou hast done this," as if he had said, "Thou, Satan, hadst sinned before this, and hadst been condemned, when thou didst fall from heaven. And now, to that sin, thou hast added this one. Thou hast, by the abuse of the serpent, hurled man into sin also. Therefore, in the first place, the serpent shall bear this punishment, that whereas, before it partook of that blessing which all other beasts also enjoyed, now it alone shall remain under my curse." From all these circumstances, it must follow as a manifest consequence that the serpent, before the sin of the fall, was the most beautiful creature among the beasts which God had made, and most delightful to man, as are at this day kids and lambs and kittens to us, and also that it moved with its head erect, and moreover, that it now creeps upon the ground is not a property of its original nature, but the consequence of the divine curse. Just in the same manner as they are the consequences of the curse, that the woman conceived in uncleanness, brings forth in sorrow, and nurses and trains her offspring with toils and griefs. Were there no curse, the whole process of creation would be most pure and holy, the giving birth to children most easy and delightful, and the training up of children the highest pleasure. Sin, therefore, has not only utterly corrupted nature itself, but most basely defiled it. And yet the human reasoners, even of our day, dare to affirm that the original properties of nature have remained essentially sound and whole, even in devils. But if the serpent, which Satan had abused to effect the sin of the fall, bore such a punishment on account of that sin, that whereas before it was the most beautiful of all creatures, it now, on a sudden, crawled on the ground upon its belly, and drew after it its viperous tail before the eyes of Adam, and thus all on a sudden became an object of hatred and of dread, how can we doubt that the same was the utterly changed case with the man, who was the very one who had committed the sin and had imbibed into his very nature the poison of Satan? As therefore the Egyptians beheld, not without the greatest amazement, the rod thrown down by Moses suddenly changed into a serpent, just so in paradise, immediately upon God's uttering this word of the curse, the serpent was changed from a form the most beautiful into an object the most disgusting and revolting. And to this same curse pertains that which God moreover said, "And dust thou shalt eat all the days of thy life." The allegorists explain this as meaning that Satan would render men given up to the love of earthly things one with himself by deceiving them. But as I have said, God is here speaking to the serpent as such and cursing the serpent, causing it to bear its punishment of the sin of the fall. For there are other beasts which also feed upon the earth, but the serpent eats the earth as its curse, that whereas before it had a certain peculiar gift of subtlety and of beauty and of food also, which it enjoyed in common with man, it now bore as its punishment that the nature of its food was changed. It is the glory of sheep, of oxen, and of other beasts that they feed on herbs and even on the fruits of trees, and also that they produce various things useful for the food of man, such as butter, milk, their own flesh, etc. The serpent also possessed this glory of his feeding in common with the other beasts, but now he is cast out from this society, and, as it were, from this common table and common feasting on account of the sin of the fall, so that he is not permitted to feed upon even the most useless herb, nor on apples or pears or nuts, on which even the mice feed. These he dare not taste. He eats the crude earth only. These are not my words, but the words of Moses, and they teach us that the nature of the serpent is entirely changed and wholly different from what it originally was. And though I have said, and it is true, that it is to the serpent that here God speaks, and yet so speaks, that his words are directed all the time more expressly against Satan, as the following part of the narrative will still more plainly show, yet I am by no means satisfied that those things spoken, which rightly apply to the nature of the serpent, should be transferred allegorically as intended to be spoken to Satan, like Augustine transfers them, and is followed by Lyra. For the serpent and Satan were intimately connected in the sin of the fall, though Satan was the principal actor, and the serpent only the instrument. And therefore it is that they are made alike partakers of the punishment. The serpent, however, bears a corporal punishment only. But for Satan, the author and agent of the whole, a different judgment is prepared, even that judgment concerning which Christ speaks, John 16:11, when he says, "Because the prince of this world is judged." The description of this judgment will now shortly follow, as recorded by Moses in the succeeding verses. Wherefore, when many say that the devil, like the serpent, no longer walks erect, and that he has lost his original form and stature, the things they say are true, but they are quite inappropriate here and have nothing to do with the right interpretation of the passage now in question. And when I said above that the serpent, before the curse of God upon it, moved in an erect posture, I do not wish to be understood to mean that it moved in an upright position as man, but with its neck and head erect as a stag or a peacock. To crawl on its belly, therefore, after the curse, was the divine judgment on the serpent. That which now follows belongs expressly to Satan only, and the things here recorded of him by Moses paint forth his judgment in far more true colors than any of those foolish and out-of-place descriptions of the allegorists. They, moreover, set before us this strong consolation that the devil is now so situated that he cannot attack and harm us at his liberty, as he wishes to do and would do if the seed of the woman stood not directly in his way.